KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It was about 15 years ago in 1998 that Sofia Coppola made her first film, The Short Licked the Star, which is about a group of young women trying to figure out their own relationship to power in unconventional ways. Since then, she's done an adaptation of The Virgin Suicides, her Oscar-winning Lost in Translation, The Terrific Marie Antoinette, and Somewhere. Her newest film is The Bling Ring, which is another examination of young women trying to examine their power in unique ways. First of all, welcome back. It's so good to see you here.
Thanks, Elvis. I'm happy to be here.
The movie is about the true story of The Bling Ring, the group of young people who were burglarizing the homes of the famous in Hollywood Hills, and that kind of image, and that this whole thing turned out to be basically a big fake reality show, just struck me as being kind of completely funny. And just their pursuit is one of the things that clearly attracted you to this.
Yeah, that they, these kids were so obsessed with these kind of tabloid stars, and that they talked about wanting to be a part of the lifestyle that everyone wants to be a part of, as if everyone does want to be a part of that. So I thought it was so extreme, their fascination with that side of our culture.
But it's interesting too, because again, I just think about your movie so much about young women and the kind of sort of blossoming young women and their relationship, the sort of like physical and emotional power. And this is a really interesting take on that. I mean, I just did find myself thinking about Lick the Star when I was watching it.
Yeah, when I was writing the script for Bling Ring, I was trying to think, like, what were they thinking and get into their minds of how this all could have happened, because it seems so absurd from the outside. And a lot of it, I thought, was the group dynamic. And so I tried to remember being that age, and there's, you know, usually the kind of the ringleader and then the other kids trying to go along with that and doing things you would never do on your own, but try to be, the whole idea of it trying to be part of a group, and it's so specific with that age. So it's something that I was interested in and did in Lick the Star, and so it reminded me of that, going back to that kind of theme that always, or that dynamic that was interesting to me.
And also on the sort of competition for primacy, it reminds me a little bit of Marie Antoinette.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that part. I thought people have compared it because of just the excess and the stuff. But I guess they're connecting.
Yeah, that sort of group dynamic too, where basically this is between a guy and a girl who's sort of like competing to be the center of this whole thing. But in some way, they're all competing. I'm just thinking about that court dynamic and just how kind of poisonous it became in Marie Antoinette. In a weird way, this is happening. It happens here in this movie a little bit too.
Yeah, I feel like that's like a high school thing, that kind of clique mentality, and definitely the court felt a lot like that kind of high school mentality. So yeah, there is a connection. I didn't even think about that part.
But also too, that kind of ambition that kind of has no place to go, which is very much a part of that court of Marie Antoinette. I mean, just, and this kind of ambition that's almost like this hormonal thing for teenagers.
Yeah, there is that. I guess you can compare it to the kind of social climbing in Versailles. But yeah, there's a lot of them, you know, trying to find their identity. So this ambition to be somebody, and the way they think to do it is to be like these tabloid stars and have that same stuff and wear their underwear. And, you know, the whole, I think there's a lot of kind of identity confusion, identity theft at that age, and the whole kind of single white female side of that age.
Well, literal identity theft in this case.
Exactly.
I read Nancy Jo Sale's book and just shocked at how much dialogue you pulled right out of these kids' mouths.
Yeah, I mean, I took so much from the transcripts, and you wouldn't believe it, but I remember hearing about when one of the girls was arrested, that she asked the detective, what did Lindsay say? You know, that's what she was thinking about. So it was pretty far out reading the real perspectives of the kids, and that I found that really fascinating.
Now, talk about the way you cast them all, the actors you find, because I guess looking at these pictures, they're all just kind of these big, strapping American kids, and they're a much smaller group of people in this movie in some weird way.
I don't know. I mean, it was really fun to work with Fred Roos, one of my producers, who's a casting genius.
And who goes back for many, many years with your father.
Yeah, and he's known for doing The Outsiders, and he really has a gift for finding, discovering people. And so he helped me with our casting team to find the kids, and it was, you know, exciting to find these actors. Some of them, it was their first movie.
You're so often casting people and using them in ways that are very different. I mean, just the way you use Emma Watson in this. I mean, having somebody that famous playing somebody who's hungry to be famous.
Yeah, and now that I think about it, I'm really impressed that she pulled it off, that she doesn't stand out as Emma Watson, because the whole story is about that. And I was aware of that when I kind of went into it. But yeah, I thought she really pulled it off, how she transformed into this kind of L.A. Valley girl.
But I guess I just find myself interested, too, because it's there's so much light in this. I mean, there's so much outdoors during daylight kind of thing. And I tend to think of you as living in sort of a shadow world. And when you show L.A. is in somewhere, it's kind of sun-baked and sort of harsh. And it's almost like you're showing Calabasas in those areas, the kind of glamour they were aspiring to in the way the film was shot.
Oh, I wanted to have a real contrast between these, like, beige suburban Calabasas home life versus the sparkly, glittery Hollywood glamorous world, and to really contrast the look of them. So they're out at night and you always see the sparkly skyline and the palm trees and the glamorous side that they're trying to get to, and that their home life is really bland. And
yeah, because the Calabasas stuff looks like a manila envelope.
Yeah, exactly. It's all so beige. And all those houses, we would get mixed up with which house we were even shooting at, because they all have the same layout. And yeah, so it was pretty, yeah, grim compared to this glamorous world that, you know, you could try to understand that they were trying to get to.
It's a treatment. We're talking with Sofia Coppola, who's back for her new film, The Bling Ring. And I just found this whole thing with that kind of quest that Emma's family has for that weird spirituality, just to be, there were so many contradictions. And just going to read Nancy's book, there were even more contradictions in the real life case than there were in what you dramatized. And how did you pick what to use and what not to use?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, I didn't want it to get too, I mean, definitely there's a lot of humor in it, and it's so
it's completely kinda absurd.
Yeah, it's so over the top. But I don't know, I watched the reality show, and then I looked through her transcripts, and you just kind of take the
Pretty Wild you watched?
Yes, I watched Pretty Wild. And that's where I had an impression of their home life, which is based on, I mean, I'm sure they're acting for the reality camera, so it's probably a heightened version of their real home life. But
I'm not sure if heightened is the word I use, but yes, I know what you
mean. Yes, yes, but definitely it was rich with inspiration of, you know, where they were coming from.
So many of your movies have been about people who basically have to break through self-obsession to figure out who they are. And this is a case where that doesn't happen. I mean, they don't ever get past the kind of narcissism to figure out the relationship to the real world. And I wonder if that was one of the things that you found attracted you to this.
I didn't think of that consciously. I can see what you're saying, but I was thinking about the whole idea of kind of fascination with celebrity culture that I was thinking about somewhere, and then this felt like a continuation of it. But just because it was so, it just seems like it's growing in our culture. And when I read the story, it was something that could only have happened now. You know, it could have happened 10 years ago. And yeah, I just thought it was interesting and timely.
Because the fascinating thing is, too, is that one of the cops says that it's amazing that nobody ever thought to break into the celebrities' homes before.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it was so audacious that they did this. But I think because they're kids, you know, they had the kind of the balls to even do that.
But it's weird, too, because, again, that's kind of seems like a thing that a kid would do. I mean, then does it really start off as a prank at first, just like breaking into friends' houses?
Yeah.
And then, but again, what you're talking about, because of the complete access that people have to celebrity homes all the time, I just remember reading the Vanity Fair piece, just being shocked, thinking, do you just go on Google and find out where somebody lives and get a picture of their house?
Yeah, and I feel like there's less and less boundaries, that they felt like they almost knew them because they're in communication with them through Twitter, and they, you know, they know all these details about them. So I felt like they almost felt like they could go hang out at so-and-so's house, like they knew them almost.
I've also seen this kind of thing, too, that's happened now with this breakdown of boundaries that you're talking about. Is there used to be a real separation between celebrity and everyday people, and part of that was just that movies made celebrities big. You know, there's a kind of size that you got from being in movies, but now there's this kind of breakdown that comes from Twitter and from people being on reality shows and for TMZ that I think makes these people feel much closer now.
Yeah, definitely. There's not the mystique, and there is this accessibility and so much information that I think it definitely had a big effect on that.
But you also have an interest, too, in sort of peeking through mystique, because so many of these movies you've done have been about characters who've had a kind of a mystique.
Yeah, and I guess this one, it's an extension of that, but sort of the opposite, too, and this idea that anybody can be a celebrity, and they're aware of their audiences on Facebook and posting pictures. So I thought it was, yeah, a different side of looking at that.
And also kind of an anti-romantic, because there's something kind of Byronic in the way that you look at mystique, and there's nothing romantic about this whatsoever.
Yeah, this is definitely a different look at it.
And it also, it's maybe since Life with Zoe, it was the most complete out-and-out comedy you've ever done, to me.
Oh, yeah, it's funny, because I don't think of that as my, I feel like it's more my dad's story. Like, we did that together, but he was trying to teach me about writing, but it was really his story, more based on his childhood. And
okay.
Yeah, I don't totally feel like it's really my work.
But there's a farcical aspect to this that, with the exception of some scenes in each of the movies.
Oh, yeah, that has more. Yeah, I mean, I enjoy that, and that's part of what I liked about the story, is because I thought it was disturbing, but then it had so much humor in it.
I mean, did you think at one point that it was going to be a drama? Because there was even like a Lifetime movie that was like incredibly sort of like melodramatic and flat.
Yeah, I didn't watch that. I heard they were doing that, and I didn't even want to watch that.
I assume you're not a big Lifetime watcher in Paris, yes.
Yeah, no. I always like things that have, you know, some humor in them, especially, you know, dark humor, which I thought this is, this definitely has.
But I just thought, too, I mean, this plays more like out-and-out comedy than anything you'd done before. And
oh,
I just wondered, in kind of tunnel terms, if that was something you were thinking about as well.
I wasn't. I mean, that's what I enjoyed about the story, is that it was so kind of absurd and touching, and then had all this humor. But I didn't really approach it like I was doing a full-on comedy. And I thought Leslie Mann and Emma Watson did a really good job of still keeping the humor there, but not making it a spoof.
Yeah,
they played mother and daughter, but not making it a, you know, comedy skit or a spoof.
No, it's not. Yeah. I mean, because it's still played completely real. Again, as I'm saying, there's so much actual dialogue.
Yeah. Yeah, just the real material had so much humor in it.
Oh, you must have almost thought, this is, do they know? Did you get to spend much time with them at all?
I didn't. I talked a lot with Nancy Jo, and she had spent time with them. But I met one of the girls and the boy. And
which girl did you meet?
Alexis Nayers, okay. And I met Nick Prugo. And I just heard more of their impressions of that time. And everyone had a kind of different take on it.
Oh, yes, they all had kind of a different take. Interesting, though, that Nick seems to be the one who was most consumed with guilt about their life.
You thought Nick was? I didn't think about that.
Yeah, because he, you know, he wants to have this relationship, and he's the one who really takes the fall for all of this.
Yeah, the main boy and girl, the ringleader, and the character Mark, who's based on Nick. Yeah, they have such an intense friendship, which I think you only have at that age. And I watched Heavenly Creatures again, and I'm trying to remember that super intense friendship where you meet someone and you're best friends the next day, and there isn't this natural progression, like more as an adult life, but it can be so intense at that age.
And also in that way in Heavenly Creatures, where at a certain age the sexual boundaries don't exist in the way they would if you were a few years older. I mean, so
Yeah,
so it's not, we're not quite sure if it's a heterosexual love or if he's in love with her and he's not straight. I mean, it's just, and that's what you're talking about with Heavenly Creatures, is just this sort of need to be part of this thing.
And to be connected, and it's not even quite clear what it is exactly, yeah. And they're trying to figure it out.
And to talk about casting, Mark.
Israel.
Yeah.
Yeah, we just met. My casting team spent a year meeting every young actor, and when I first saw him, Israel Broussard, he didn't have the look that I imagined the character to have. But
what was the look? Did you want to be closer to the real Nick?
I thought the real Nick was into fashion, and you know, and Israel was this kid from the South who's into sports, and it's not at all like that. He just didn't look like the character, but I just thought he had this naturalness and this, you know, kind of touching quality that you could connect with this kid, and that, you know, a little bit of an awkwardness that makes you feel for him, and you can see he's really that age where he's trying to figure it out.
Well, we'll take a break. My guest is Sofia Coppola. It's good to have her back. Her new film as writer-director is The Bling Ring. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Want more of The Treatment? Join us on Facebook and be part of the conversation. Search for The Treatment and click like.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest is Sofia Coppola, who's been away for 10 years.
Glad to be back.
It's good to have you back. We're talking about a new film, Bling Ring, but also kind of sort of catching up career-wise with you. And it's interesting that there's often one character who sort of is very quiet in the films. I mean, somebody who's kind of watchful, but it's more like somebody who's not capable of articulating themselves, be it Mark here, or in some respects it's Stephen Dorff in Somewhere, and sometimes it's Kristen Dunst in Marie Antoinette, and even a little bit Scarlett Johansson in Lost in Translation. I wonder what it is you like about those characters who can be quiet while so much is going around them.
Yeah, I like stories where the characters are in transition and they're trying to figure out or emerge, and so where the drama is more coming internally from the character than from an outside plot. So I guess that's something that's always interested me. And this one, there's more happening outside the story, but they are in transition and trying to find their identity, I think.
And this is one of the cases where the character is kind of a catalyst rather than having things happen surrounding them and then just kind of reacting to it and stepping out of this world. It's kind of this sort of break between the past and the future. And here it's not happening so much. I mean, it's very much present in a way that doesn't seem in the other movies to me.
Yeah, I feel like this one was different for me. I mean, I've never done anything that was based on a true crime story. So for me, it was a challenge of how to do this type of movie, but still in my style. So I feel like it's different than the other films, but they're connected and in themes. But I think it's a different style in this one.
That's very much a different style. It feels so much like kind of present tense. And I wondered if, again, pop culture has changed so much in these years that it's happened that it feels really almost like a period film.
Yeah, it's funny because my friends were saying, are you going to do it period? But it was like 2 years before so we were like, no, we're not going to, just let's use contemporary phones and not worry and just make it kind of this world of pop culture and kind of that tabloidy look.
But they're still talking about people, though, who's, how best to put this, who's, who are, you kind of think as being more from a few years ago than right now.
Yeah, the Kardashians weren't in this story where they probably would have been if it happened today.
Yeah, and I just wonder, too, if you want, because it kind of feels in a weird way almost fable-like.
Huh.
Because there's a beginning, the definite beginning, middle, and end to this in a way that there haven't often been in the stories you've told.
Yeah, it has more of a narrative than how I've worked before. So that to me was a challenge to do a story that, you know, it had to unfold in a certain way, but how to approach that and still in my own style. I looked at, you know, what part of the story I wanted to tell, and I wanted to stay in the kids' point of view and just tell about this little moment in their life, and it ends when they get arrested and not what happens after that and before that, and just, you know, starting with the relationship when the boy got involved with this group of girls that led him down this path. And to me, the story, I wanted it to be like kind of the thrill ride that they were on. And I mean, I even thought about, I mean, I love in Goodfellas that whole helicopter sequence when it's really stressful, and I wanted to have a little anxiety and his paranoia. And
how did you sort of make this choice to tell the story in the way you decided to? I mean, just kind of unfolding in like almost a real-time kind of way.
I mean, I wanted to have a little bit of a collage feeling because we're mixing surveillance footage and, you know, what they're looking on the internet and posting pictures. But I thought the story was, you know, enough to tell it, to go along with the ride. And I wanted to really feel like you're with the kids. So I felt like you wanted to keep going forward and not kind of flash around too much and not have a distance, really be in it and experiencing it with them.
Did you kind of feel like you wanted to do something that was quite a bit different than things you've done in the past?
I think right after Somewhere, because that was so minimal and quiet and slow, I was definitely in the mood to do something obnoxious and fast-paced. And it was fun to kind of get into trash culture because it's not something that I indulge in my real life all the time.
I mean, it's really a different kind of movie. When I heard that you were doing it, I thought, this is... Did you click with the material immediately when you saw it, or what happened?
Yeah, when I read the article, I just thought, someone's got to be making a movie of this. This would be a great movie. It had all the elements of, like, it's fun and pop and then disturbing, and it was such a ride and so hard to believe. And I just felt like it had the elements that... I like the idea of also trying to make a movie that's a popcorn movie and also has an artful quality, so how to do both. Yeah, and I feel like it could appeal to kids and then also to a sophisticated older audience, I think. So I don't know, I felt like it was a challenge to me of how to do it, but I felt like it had contrasting elements.
It's a tribute. The person who's beating her elbows on a desk across from me, Sofia Coppola, we're talking about her newest film, which is Bling Ring. As you're talking about, it looks like you were taking aim at a bigger target than you had in the past. You were trying to do a lot more things. I mean, because the other movies feel very specific, and again, because you're kind of taking on pop culture in this movie, contemporary pop culture, and you often comment in a way that pop culture can be a dangerous and addictive thing. This is a movie about people who are mainlining pop culture in their own weird way.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think there's that side of it that's fun to look at once in a while, but the fact that it's become so dominant in our culture, it just seems like it's growing and growing, and I appreciate it in small doses, but it just seems like to the kids in the story, it was all their input was coming from that, and I just thought it was something to look at and look at where it's going and how we feel about it.
Yeah, and there's often kind of a bad girl in the movies, each one of these movies. And that archetype is so interesting because you never judge those characters. You sort of say, well, this is who these women are.
Oh, good. Yeah, I really tried not to be judgmental and to, you know, try to understand and see it through their point of view, even though most of the characters in the story are pretty unsympathetic. So that was a challenge.
Well, I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but that last scene in Vegas, that scene must have been a lot of fun to direct because there's so much going on in it.
Yeah, and I read the real police report, so it was really interesting to you had to find a way to film it. And just seeing Katie Chang, the actress who played Rebecca, she's so different in real life. She's so different from that character, so it was fun to see her being really a bad girl.
I mean, what was it like, though? Because, I mean, I wonder if many of your cast members either knew the story or had opinions about these kids before they took on the parts.
I mean, they got it, and then they found ways, each themselves, to kind of connect to that stuff. And I had them watch movies that glamorized robberies, like they watched Thomas Crown Affair together and Ocean's 11, and just to get into that mindset of that they're into it, make it look fun.
But it's also so fascinating, too, to have these robberies not be about, you know, all the movies you mentioned about people going to get away with the heist because there's some reason, you know, it's either beating the system in the case of the Thomas Crown Affair or beating out some guy who, like, took your girl and getting his money in Ocean's 11. And they had no real motive except they just wanted to, like, rent this stuff.
And they wanted to be a part of this world that they thought would make them into something important. It's kind of touching that they really thought, you know, wanted to be a part of something that, you know, to us seems so lost.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because they're trying to kind of extend their childhood, you know what I mean, like trying to join some other club.
Yeah, I think, yep. I think it's natural also that age you want to be a part of the in crowd.
What were those years like for you? I mean, where were you living? Were you in the Bay Area?
High school? Yeah, I was up in Napa Valley in a small town going to high school. And, you know, I was, like, into going to see bands. And, you know, I remember you spending tons of time, like, driving around, going nowhere with your friends. And
did you make the move driving to San Francisco a lot to see music and stuff?
Yeah, we would go to San Francisco to see bands.
Because, again, I'm just wondering if it felt like that same, the move from Napa Valley to San Francisco kind of felt like going from the suburbs into the big city in that way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it feels to me so different than this story because I don't remember being so glamorous, but it was exciting to go in the city and see bands.
Well, because they lived basically in Calabasas, a place where the suburbs where all the celebrities live anyway, so they could see them all the time.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about that part of it.
The thing you do in the movie is that you kind of see there's this remove between where they live and the world that they go to is compared to, I mean, that's the big difference for me between the actual case when they were surrounded by it all the time and this sort of celebrity of people who are famous for just being celebrity was kind of rubbed in their faces all the time.
Yeah.
And then that clearly was a conscious decision for you to not have that when they were home, to eliminate that surrounding or being surrounded by celebrity they had in their real lives.
Yeah, but I don't think it was that common to them. I still think it's probably a big deal if you saw the Osbournes at the supermarket. But it's true, it is more a part of your life being in Los Angeles because you do see celebrities around in regular places.
But I just thought, too, that was, again, sort of this way of still giving it a bit of mystique. They had to travel to get to it.
Yeah, that's true. It would have been different if they saw them at the supermarket. So I was trying to make it this world they were trying to get to.
And talk about the music you picked for the movie, too.
Oh, yeah, I always loved that part. I worked with my friend Brian Reitzel, who I've done other soundtracks with, and I was listening to music when I was writing the script. So when I first started, I was listening to that sleigh bell song that we used for the opening sequence, and I wrote that sequence for that song, and we played that on set.
I love those guys, too, so I'm glad you used that song.
Oh, yeah, I was really glad we could use it. And then we played music on set when they were in the club, and some of those songs ended up in the movie. And it was fun because it's not my usual world, and, like, I, you know, I never thought I'd have a movie with the Rick Ross song on the soundtrack. So, so it's always fun to do something, you know, not your usual thing.
And just before we go, I wanted to ask you, because we had a mutual friend who had started work on the movie, wasn't able to finish it, our friend Harris Avidas, who was just the greatest. And when, talk about the first time you met him and talked him into working with you.
I loved working with Harris. I met him, my friend Ann Ross, who was a production designer on this, said, oh, there's this, you know, I've met this DP, this guy you're going to love, you have to meet him. And so we ended up doing a commercial together, a Dior perfume commercial, and we, you know, we hit it off, and like everybody, I just instantly loved Harris. And we were talking during this commercial we did about what we liked and didn't like about movies, and we were both talking about how we hated coverage and how simply you could do things. And from talking to him, I got excited to write Somewhere, because it came a lot from this excitement of how simply you could tell a story. So that was the first film we did together. And so when I told him about this movie, about The Bling Ring, I had a few different things I was talking about. He said, oh, what about that story about the kids robbing the houses? Like, he was excited about it, which kind of gave me the encouragement that it was something worthwhile to pursue, because, you know, just that he was interested at all in that story. And so he was excited to help me find the look. And I never shot on digital before, so Harris thought that was the best way to shoot this movie. And then, unfortunately, he was sick and had to leave for some of the shoot, but Chris Blavel, who had worked with him before, did a great job of filming when Harris couldn't be there, and they really did it together. So I'm really grateful to him. And there was, like, the shot of the glass house that's supposed to be Adrina Patrick from across the hill. That was a real Harris shot that, because they're doing the same thing over and over again, robbing these houses, we didn't want it to feel repetitive, you know, too repetitive, so we're trying to think of different ways to shoot each robbery. And he came up with this shot from across the street with a slow zoom, and it's one of my favorite shots, and people always mention it. And I'm so grateful that he pushed for it, because there were times when we were going to take it off the schedule. He really fought that we keep that shot, and so I'm so glad that to get to spend that time with him and to have his help to make this.
But you can see it in these two movies, and that's why I was talking so much about the nighttime stuff too, because it really is. Harris did something in shooting night, just... because I watched Zodiac again after I saw your movie, just thinking about how much that takes place at night.
Oh, yeah.
There's something he does with sort of like night air that's kind of unique to him, I always thought.
Yeah, I haven't thought about that. And I haven't seen Zodiac in a long time, but I remember it was so great looking. I'd like to watch it again. But yeah, there is some kind of atmosphere that he builds. And I always think of it in the way he shoots light and daylight, but it's true in the night scenes they really have some kind of, I don't know, dreamy quality, but
it's almost like a visible humidity. If there's something like that,
yeah,
you can do.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
Well, I hope you come back and see us in less than 10 years, for God's sake.
Thank you. I will.
So great having you back, and I really like the movie. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks, Elvis. Thanks for having me.
My guest is Sophia Koppler. Her newest movie is Bling Ring. Our recording engineer at KCRW is Melissa Morton, who also mixes the show. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.